And it's humbling to move from last night's movie, Minor Shot Down, and actually the theater the night before about water. And in some ways I feel like they both said it better than I might. But what I'd like to do is play with you a little bit about some ideas about precarity. As a really important, I think, construct that we're all living with. It's a construct that I would say is promiscuous. That is, it has been and might be used to think about structural issues, but also affective issues and existential issues and aesthetic issues. And it's also just humbling to come from the United States here, and to meet people from Portugal and from the Dominican Republic and Ecuador, where bodies are literally dangling. They're dangling from the economy. They're dangling from hopes for freedom. And in the United States, particularly those of us who are white, we think we are watching that rather than producing the conditions of the dangling. So all those crazy awards from the terrorist organization known as the American Psychological, and I guess I just want to say we're all in these contradictions. South Africa's been very generous to let me and the rest of us from outside the country in on your contradictions, but we're all in them. Gloria Anzaldúa calls them choques, kind of those moments of conflict and clash. And what has been beautiful about this conference is that we've had the opportunity to enter those choques rather than act as though they're not a part of the work that we do. So let me try to give some different framings on precarity and then dive into a couple of examples of my own work where we've been kind of playing with precarity. And I have said, I was speaking to Garth about this morning, and he was referencing the precariat, right, which is a term generated now in contrast to proletariat. And I'm actually not interested in creating a new category of person, a new population. I do want to argue that precarity, that is, that sense of the predictability of the unpredictable, the experience of contingency and fear, the deep embodied sense of insecurity, is at this moment global. It is structural. Some of us are paying a much higher price than others, but it's existential and affective, and it's in all of our bodies. So Judith Butler gives the most benign framing on precarity, and she says, what's beautiful about precarity is that it's a reminder of our interdependence, our vulnerabilities, and our needs. Saskia Sassan says the precarity is the savage sorting of winners and losers. Jasper Puar calls for a geopolitical genealogy of precarity to understand who is vulnerable, who is making us vulnerable, and what are the embodied consequences of that. And Lauren Berlant talks about precarity as a fuse to slow death. In the essay Necropolitics, I can say this well enough, Achelle Mbembe, close, not even in the neighborhood, reminds us that we are living in a time where political and policy decisions are being made that determine who will live and who will die. I have had the honor for 30 years of hanging out with low-income young people all over the United States, and chronicling the policies and practices that have abbreviated their yearning lives. We are witnessing a redistribution of life sentences. But precarity, I want to argue, just maybe for today. The precarity is a construct that maybe we can play with. And I want to give us 7 framings on precarity that I made up last night, or maybe 6. The numbers thing is my thing. And then give you three examples, and then we can chat about whether this is a useful construct for us. Precarity has been the rallying cry of the indignados in Spain, of the Syriza in Greece, of Occupy in New York. But I want to import it into psychology because it's actually a profoundly social psychological idea that we are all unsure of what tomorrow will be, but we know it could and might very well be worse. Again, I don't mean to diminish that some of us are paying a much higher price than others, but we are all living with the existential anxiety. So here are the six frames that, and I'll play with three. One is, I think psychology already does a fair amount on precarity, and it frames it as risk, right? There's probably research on all the ways in which some young people live more precarious lives, and they are therefore at risk for unsafe sex, for drinking, for what else? Depression, suicide, hurting themselves, hurting other people, right? So we're going to put precarity right into their bodies and hold them accountable as though they were the cause rather than the outcome of precarious struggle. And one of the pathologies of that framing is that it's deployed by conservatives but also progressives. The progressives in psychology, in health, in education have relied on evidence of damage as evidence of injustice. It's a huge problem in our field. We say, it's so unfair, you are so broken. And that's been the history in feminist psychology, in black psychology, in Latino, in disability, and now in queer studies. And psychology is really the handmaiden of a deficit damage discourse by the right and the left. And I would like us to stop. The second way, and I'll dig more deeply, is I think precarity offers us a way to think about an epistemology of precarity. That is, how do young people who live profoundly precarious, disrupted lives view the world? Right? And I feel like I've been very lucky to meet young people who are contending with imprisoned parents and deported parents and schools that are closing and teachers that are being changed and being yanked out of their homes or placed in foster care, or in the States there's a group called Foster by Gay. Gay kids who are undocumented end up in the foster care system. Foster care, right, they're taken from their families. Their families sometimes give them up because they're bringing too much attention. There are a number of ways in which lives and policies are producing disruption. And for a moment, I want us to entertain the possibility that that produces a way of viewing the world that we need to understand. Some people might call it paranoia, right? Some of the young people whose relationships have been so severed mistrust relationships. They don't move to hope very quickly. And yet it is a line of vision from which I hope we can learn something, and I'll return to it. The third enactment of precarity that I've seen in the States and maybe we saw in the film last night is the precarity of elites. And at least in the States, when elites feel precarious or unsure of their settings, of their stability, we're witnessing an aggressive appetite for greed and for reclaiming of space, power, and control. And if I have a footnote here, because I'm definitely going to run out of time, I would encourage us to be interrogating the health psychology of privilege and the voracious appetite for control and greed and domination of elites. We saw it in the film last night. We see it in the States and real estate and closing schools and reopening them in devastating, particularly low-income black communities, as if for their own good. W.E.B. Du Bois in the early 1900s started a journal called The Crisis, And in it, there's a beautiful poem by Lowell, which talks about the point of Crisis magazine is to chronicle the moans of the darker race. And Du Bois goes on to say, those moans are chronic, but they are only attended to when there's a profit to be made. And that's what we're witnessing in the United States, the exploitation of black pain for white pain. So elite precarity has produced an aggressive appetite. I'm probably going to develop that more, but I would like us to be thinking about it. The fourth and related is that precarity is now being exploited by elites to privatize. So in places, again, like the United States, you can go into low-income black communities and feed on the fact that public education has systematically betrayed those communities. And you can dangle the tragedy of the illiterate black child to seduce those parents to exit the public sector, turn on teachers and public schools, show up at rallies and attack other parents who are in public schools, and then a year later throw their kids out of the private school that you seduced them into. I can unpack that a little more if you'd like. But right now, the precarity of low-income communities of color is being exploited as foreplay to privatization. I bumped into here. I keep bumping into it. We've certainly got it in the U.S. We got it in the morning after Arab Spring, the morning after Occupy. It's the precarity that comes with the disappointments of hope. The morning after MOURNING. At this, somebody referenced it as the tomorrow that didn't come. And in the movie last night, it was that moment where the miners turned to the police and said, "You're our black brothers." And I do think there's, for us, maybe I'm just being narcissistic, but I'll just say for all of us, there's a kind of depression about what we hope for Obama, what we hope for the ANC, what we hope for Arab Spring. And that's a different kind of precarity. It's like an emotional precarity. To trust hope again is very hard. And the sixth, the most exciting, and I promise I will leave you upbeat, maybe. The sixth is, I think, precarity is giving us a space, if we can take it, to rethink possibilities, to rethink categories, to rethink structural alignments, to rethink identities. And I will end with the study we're doing with LGBT youth of color, who are rethinking every category I ever thought I knew, right? And are using precarity as a liminal space, potentially, for liberation, not just. So can you live with those six? Is that, are we all right? So I'm going to take you into three studies, and we'll just do a taste. Okay, do you know tapas? You're just going to have a taste of these three studies, and each example will be like a theory method story. Right, so I'll try to offer a little bit of theory and a little bit of method. So the first scene is where I want to help us see an epistemology of precarity. What would it mean if we understood the line of vision that grows in precarity as a form of wisdom rather than deficit? And that will come from some work that I've done as a legal expert in court cases. Mostly I'm invited to be an expert in cases where kids go to crappy schools. Very interesting question, but somehow in the United States, you need to pay somebody to come in and say, actually, going to bad schools is bad for your academic and physical health. And because there are people who say, money doesn't matter, they're poor anyway, their mothers are not raising them anyway, that, you know, they have so many problems, good schools couldn't matter at all. And footnote that I will not develop at all, but will leave you. The question is, what happened to your old South Africa's investment in education with freedom? But, so I'm going to go into the legal story and epistemology of precarity. Then we're going to move very, very briefly, because I want to get to the good news, to what precarity as a condition that elites are contending with, and what we in the States are calling accumulation by dispossession. That is, drawing on Rosa Luxemburg and then David Marx and then David Harvey, and I brought some of these ideas into psychology. But the ways in which elites are appropriating public space, accumulating profit by dispossessing others, and that is getting framed as progress for everybody. I think that might be happening here too. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we love to do in the United States, and I worry that you love to do here, is to have a very diverse top, a very diverse group of elites. So it just doesn't look like white people ripping everybody. So we have a little gay and a little immigrant and a lot of our major policy changes. Jody Melvin calls this multicultural neoliberalism, right? Where we kind of complicate and diversify the top, recruit folks into the top as good examples, but it's a seduction to betray the rest of the community from which they come. So we love gay marriage. It's awesome. We love the dreamers, you know, the really, really excited undocumented immigrant kids who should go to college. And as soon as we do that, we're going to forget about their fathers and grandparents and everybody working in the kitchens or getting shot at the border. Right? We love releasing nonviolent offenders, right? Kids picked up for marijuana sales, but we're going to forget about the rest of incarceration. Apparently, the other day, we decided that transgender people can be in the U.S. military. Very complicated. And the United States has a terrible history of granting people inclusion when they agree to participate in the military. We've done it with Puerto Ricans. This round, we did it with undocumented Latinos. If they participated in any of those awful wars and lived and remembered, they might be citizens. So the second example is about accumulation by dispossession and the yearning for a kind of multicultural elite that sells out everybody else. And again, I don't mean to be cynical about all of those accomplishments. There are transgender in the military, which you talk about. But, you know, gay marriage, and those are amazing accomplishments, but there's a price of inclusion. Not dissimilar than what Leslie talked about yesterday, but now the kids with cerebral palsy don't play soccer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when inclusion means assimilation and selling out the groups. So that's the second line. And then the third line, I want to leave us with some thinking about precarity as a potentially liberatory site, a place to play. And then I'm going to give you little bits on our new project. All right? You good? Yeah. So we're going to dive into tapas one. I will leave you hungry, but you'll have the taste in your mouth. I have had the unbelievable good fortune of being invited to be an expert witness. Category is all wrong. Mm-hmm. Neither an expert nor a witness. In legal cases around grandma and grandpa live in Alabama. So in the country says, Kane, who are you taking to the prom? And he says, I am taking 7 white girls. Anyway, there's lots of interesting complexities in that case. I walked into the church the night before. I was supposed to meet with the black elders from the church. This isn't really about precarity, but it's a great story. I walk into and I thought I was meeting with some group of black elders. I don't know how churches work here, but I'm driving the dark roads of Alabama, Jewish progressive. There's a long history of Jewish progressive and black people not being loved in Alabama. Anyway, I'm driving, and I get to this church expecting to meet with like 4 old black people who were going to help me figure out this case. Church is filled. 3 buses, right? Those of you who have had the joy of going to black churches know. filled with three different busloads from three different churches, all of which hate each other, of course, but have come together around the Freedom School. I walk in, only white person for miles. I'm hiding in the back, duh. And I think I'll just like wait here. And the 800-year-old minister in the front with all the microphones. California has what's called finance equity. I don't need to do too much of the, but it's useful. United States, a lot of states, children's schools are funded by local property taxes. Mm-hmm. So if you live in a wealthy neighborhood, you have wealthy schools, and if you live in a poor neighborhood, your schools are pretty under-resourced, right? So there are lawsuits for finance equity. California has finance equity, which means everybody gets very little. I think it might be a little different, but the stratification's like here. So that a wealthier community, wealthy families have a fee or contribute. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I've been invited into the low resource schools on a number of court cases. And the most recent one was the lawyers were interested in giving children more instructional time in their schools. Because in low-income schools like in Los Angeles, some of the schools have like 40 to 60% long-term subs as the teachers. They're not real teachers. They're very nice people, but they're not real teachers. Or if there's a shooting in the neighborhood, the school locks down. Or the Department of Immigration comes into the school and deports people. Or police come into the school. And so there's a lot of disruption in low-income schools. And in fact, they have less instructional time. So there was this lawsuit about increasing instructional time for low-income kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they asked me to be the expert witness. And I always say, you know, I'll come in and take care. Wonderful to meet you. I'll come in and I'll ask questions, but I don't know that I can testify about more instructional time in crappy schools. I don't know that more bad is justice. You know what I mean? It's like a funny thing because you want to get more, but anyway. So here's a moment on methods. So the way we do these lawsuits is they get random digit dialing. They get young people in focus groups. And we usually have a four-part focus group. First, we give them a survey so that we can get the quantitative stuff. Because you know when you do a focus group, it's an N of one, even if there's 10 people in it. So when I'm going to court, I want to be able to say, we surveyed 200 young people about what gets in the way of instructional time. Does that make sense? So first we gave them a survey, so we had a big enough N. Mm-hmm. Then we do a lot of identity map work. So we gave everybody paper and crayons, and I just said, draw what time feels like in your body in school. I know you all probably think, I don't know what to draw. Everybody draws. And it's quite remarkable. We do identity mapping a lot, and I'm happy to email with any of you. It's very powerful. You get affect and complexity, and you know how when we do an interview or survey, we've already framed, as we talk, we've already framed on this identity mapping. So we collected 150 maps of what time feels like in children's and teachers' bodies. And in crappy schools, it was a snail or a clock where the hand wouldn't move, or a head on desk with the teacher showing a movie, Nemo or Juice, just a stupid movie to high school kids, right? Or one kid said, when I'm in AP, like advanced classes, the picture was like this, and on the bottom, when he's not in those classes, it was prison. It was, you know, bars. But the young person I loved the most, who taught me precarity, was a young man named Carlos. And he said, do you know the movie The Wizard of Oz? Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. All right, so Carlos drew The Wizard of Oz. And he said, I'm Latino, and I'm gay, and I'm president in my class. And this is a picture of me and my friends and my teacher on the yellow brick road. And he said, and you'll see, and you, I should have brought it, you'll see some of the bodies fall off as we're walking. Because there's tests, and there's shootings, and there's gang violence, and there's deportations, but I just keep going. He said, I don't know why, but I'm good at this. And then here's the green curtains where the wizard is. And he said, I'm not even sure there is a wizard. I don't know if there's anybody behind the curtain, but I gotta keep walking. And everybody in the group is like, this is a little too hopeful for me. And then Carlos says, what you gotta watch out for are the flying monkeys. He said, because they'll, even when you're walking, you don't suspect it, they'll like come up behind you and take things or knock you over. And when Carlos introduced the flying monkeys, you know how when you do qualitative work and you're waiting for the metaphor that's going to organize everything? I just thought I could retire. Carlos. And when he said that, then the rest of the group said, I got a flying monkey because I'm supposed to. This young woman had a fancy scholarship to go somewhere. She said, but my brother was killed a month ago. And so I'm not sure, my parents are a little scared of me going to Princeton across the country. Another little boy says, my dad was deported and that was my flying monkey. Mm-hmm. And we then in the subsequent groups really used precarity as a resource. Which is very different than inviting people to expose shame, shameful stories. We then would tell that story and say, so what do you know? Because you've lived in foster care, in homeless shelters, in because your school's been closed, because the teacher you love got removed. That's the end of that story for now. But I want to say it's become very useful to think about precarity as a line of vision. A critical line of vision that is very different than psychology's assumption of secure attachments with sustained relationships, which aren't really true for anybody. Yeah. I have a foster son who was in 22 homes before he was in ours. Right? It just doesn't map on, and I have two biological kids from C-sections. It doesn't map onto their lives. Right? So there's a wisdom in precarity that I would like us to honor. And just a final example there is, we did a project with formerly incarcerated college students. I do a lot of work on with folks in prison and out of prison about the importance of college in prison and out of prison. 1994, there used to be grants for people in prison to go to college. Does this sound surprising? No. Yes, maybe. But then in 1994, Bill Clinton took the grants out. And everybody was getting tough on crime and tough on barbells and tough on television and tough on color. And when college closed, really the lights went out in a lot of prisons where college was sustenance. So we did a study of the impact of college in prison, participatory study. Half the research team was women in prison, half of us not. But the minute, and college in prison is a good thing, even conservatives should like it, it saves you a lot and it saves lives and it's transformative. But more recently we were doing a study with formerly incarcerated folks in college, and it was a participatory study again, half the researchers were formerly incarcerated folks in college, and the title of the study is The Gifts They Bring. The gifts they bring that universities don't recognize as gifts, because everybody's in the closet about it. But reflection, remorse, responsibility. I never met people who wanted to pay taxes so much. When I said, what difference does college make in your life? They say, it's how I raise my nieces and nephews. I now go to school. I want to give back. I know that I owe. I'm responsible for what I did in the past. I'm responsible. So this framing of precarity as a gift, a line of vision, damaging, consequential, wounding, bad, shouldn't be, but it's also a line of vision. I'm going to skip the privilege part. Just know that like we need to study privileged people. And one of the things that I do as like a hobby is document all the ways in which privilege pathology is hidden in psychological work. And I will just give you one example, and then I'm going to move to the other studies we've done. I was an expert witness in a case of a racially integrated school in New Jersey. So there were three communities, they all went to the same school, and the school was mixed race, mixed class. The white people from Angkor Cliffs wanted to get out of this school and go to another neighboring school, which was all white and elite. Are you with me? Does that make sense? So, because it wasn't their school, they were too small. And so I was brought in as the researcher to say, you can't really just leave because you're white. But I had to bring a little science to that. went to the school, and in fact, the way racially integrated schools work in the States, high schools in particular, is they're tracked, streamed, stratified. So most of the white kids are sitting in the top. They're going to a private school at the top. There are a few kids of color. The middle is mixed. The bottom is foreign black. So when you hear about integrated schools, that's what you should read. They are then, everybody walks in the same door, but they are through a variety of mechanisms of testing, tracking, choice. People are really stratified in terms of what kinds of educational opportunities. And the white kids in this school were getting a great education, and they were kind of socially conscious. But when I went to court, one of the things that the racially integrated school did, anytime there was a fight or drugs, they would call the police. So there's a long list of police records for the racially integrated school. And the white parents who wanted to go to the white elite school said, there are no police records. What happens when a fancy white kid at a fancy white school is caught with drugs? In my country, we call the psychiatrist or the parent. If it's a black kid, we call the cops, right? So, and that's just what we do. That's not like giving away secret, right? Well, that's very interesting, because then when you go to court, whose evidence counts? And this looks like a bad school that's filled with drugs, and this looks like a good school that has no drugs. And it's one of a zillion examples I can give you of the ways in which we white out white or elite or privileged pathology, assuming we're all pathological, right? And so in the paper, I was trying to argue that elite problems are privatized and poor problems are publicized. And our field contributes. Does that make sense? And in the midst of precarity, white people are even more anxious about making sure their kid is a tutor and a good lawyer when they get picked up for drugs. And I'm using white as a metaphor for elite or whatever. So I'm going to go to my good example. Precarity is potentially a liberatory liminal creative zone. So in the United States, we have lots of research on LGBT. Anybody want to guess what we study?
Drug use?
Suicide.
Rape?
Not rape, no.
Sexual behavior.
Depression, sexual behavior, drug use, and their attitudes toward gay marriage. Those are our specialties. The progressives look at their attitudes, all right? Cool, I'm not even being critical, except a little. So, and there's a lot of money to fetishize depression and suicide, and most of the research is done on high-end white Asian kids who are in LGBTQ organizations. So already out, already identified, activists, young people. In our work, our being the Public Science Project, go online, check it out, come to our summer institute, they're amazing. In our work, we are running into LGBT youth of color a lot. In prison, in juvenile facilities, in homeless shelters, in the suspension room, disproportionately.
We're not in the 10%, even if you believe any of it. Really high, the highest rate of suspension in New York City are gender non-conforming girls of color. And they are being stopped in the hallway by police, many of whom themselves are gender non-conforming women of color. Right? So that's an article I'll never write, I'll let you read. But anyway, friends of ours who are funders, and we do a lot of work with activist youth organizations, organizations that call themselves queer organizations, juvenile justice, who's focusing on gender nonconformity. So there's a big debate in the States about whether young people, when they're picked up by police, should be asked about sexuality in addition to race ethnicity. And there are a lot of progressive organizations that say we should be asking all this and normalizing it, and there are others who are like, oh my God, people are going to use that. Anyway, debate worth having, though. I find myself on the conservative side of, oh my God, but it's a little maternalistic, and these young ones are like, yeah, we've got to get the data. Anyway, so they asked us if we could develop. We do, almost all of the work that we do is participatory, which means that the people who have most experienced injustice have the deepest sense of the shape of the problem, the root causes, what kinds of questions are worth asking, and what kind of products are necessary for organizing policy theories. All right, so it's a, I can develop that because I'm going to stop the class so we can ask questions. And so we have some non-negotiables that all of our research is shaped by the people who most systematically understand the injustice. We believe that knowledge, expertise is widely distributed, but legitimacy is not. And in our work, we're going to tip that. We're going to do work, as Martine Butteau would argue, with a preference for the poor or the marginalized. So we're going to tilt our question to privilege the knowledge of those who have been most adversely affected. But we also do research in what we call a contact zone. I know you have trouble with contact, and I have to rethink this. But our research teams include very, very situated folks. So in the prison project, it was women in prison, women not in prison, formerly incarcerated folks. In this project, we've got queer youth, queer artists, researchers, lawyers, policymakers, advocates. That is the research team. We do a research camp where we all go away and figure out the different knowledges we bring to the work. Does that make sense? So I know a little about research methods. I don't know what it's like to be a woman in prison. I don't know what it's like to be a Latina lesbian living in New York City in 2015. So we pool our subjugated knowledges and our dominant knowledges. We read how the dominant literature represents the issue. So we read the newspapers, we read the academic literature. When we were studying street life, we brought in men who led a street life, sold drugs, sold whatever. And together we read how the academic literature represents them. They were appalled that they were simply represented as hypersexual, hyperviolent, and exploitative of the community, when they're often also ones who are buying the turkeys and taking care of folks and protecting the neighborhood. When we've done work with women who have served long sentences for killing their children, we brought in articles about women who have killed their children, but we triple spaced it and we asked them to write in what's read between the lines. What's the story being told here? And what story might you tell? Because when white women kill their kids, those are usually articles about pharmaceuticals that make women do crazy things. And when poor black women kill their kids, it's a much shorter article. There are no neighbors saying, oh my God, that's such a surprise. And the headline is usually like monster in the Bronx. So we analyze it, so we do these camps. So these funders came to us and said, could you do a national participatory survey of LGBT youth of color? So it's a little nutty, but we said yes. So we have, we're in the beginning, so it's going to sound really, really cool because we don't know all the problems yet, okay? So what we have is we have a national advisory board of adult researchers, artists, activists, and it's half youth. They are from all over the country, and they are all from intersectional organizations. So undocu-queer. Perhaps you've heard of it, right? So undocumented young people who are LGBT. Deaf lesbians. Inuit, Native, Alaskan, LGBTQ young people. Formerly incarcerated LGBT young people. So everybody's on the team. We are trying to develop a survey. Any of you do survey research?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, so you know this really well. Okay, so every item that we think about using, half the room hates, right? So we put together a core group, very diverse by every, and we just got IRB yesterday, so it's about to go live, 14 to 24, and then we have 200 organizations around the country ready to distribute it, right? So I want to tell you how we've created the survey and then what we're planning, and then I'm going to show. So we put together all these, we had groups of young people and they identify what areas. So we have to look at creativity and activism and relationships and trust. And there are some existing survey items that address those, but a lot of them we have to make up because psychology hasn't really looked at the good news. We haven't looked very much at creativity, we call it flow. But, you know, and day one items like what we're really good at is taking care of ourselves and others. What we're really good at is having a will to challenge, right? One of the things that got noticed early on in this work is that in every youth activist group in the United States, working for education reform, prison reform, immigration reform, environmental justice, among the leadership are LGBT youth of color. Mm-hmm. So much for our theories about marginalization, breaking people. Marginalization is not good for you. On the other hand, it might also be a space of radical marginality, of critical consciousness among young people who say, I don't want a seat at the table, I want to change the table. And they're not like oppositional about, like, they're just coming at an angle. And so everything gets reworked. So we put together this crazy survey. We put together what we call the wrong draft. And we invited 150 young people from activist organizations to take the wrong draft, to critique it, to add cartoons. We want cartoons in the survey. We want young people's artwork so that it's creative. We want open-ended questions. So we expected like 80 people, 150 showed up. We couldn't do it at the Graduate Center. So we had to find a Korean deli that had an upstairs, and they just started coming through the door. Now, we were paying people, so everybody was texting, come for, you know. Maria Torre and I are the two directors. We are running up and down the steps with like bread and orange juice, and the place ran out of bread. We started with them, again, with identity maps, and we just said, draw what you want the world to know about the wisdom of LGBT youth of color. And so we have 150 of the most amazing maps. But when it came time to looking at the survey, which I guess we have finalized because we're going live, the contestation around categories was so fabulous. And distressing. Fabulous because the world is shifting quickly. They hated all the categories of race and ethnicity and even sexuality and gender conformity, and only the trans women love the item that says, rate yourself on how masculine and how feminine you are. They loved it. Everybody, gender, queer, young, all these categories, right? They hated it. They just hated it, right? And then we have a section called Injustice Can Get Under Your Skin. How did these injustices, because we wanted to keep it intersectional and not just sexuality focused. So does racism affect you? Not at all, very much. And they were adding transphobia and fatphobia. And I was like, all right, this is going to the 12-year-old boy in Utah who thinks he's the only gay kid in the world. So we're trying to develop this in New York for them. And one young person who uses the pronoun they, do we do pronouns here?
Yeah.
Uses the pronoun they, African-American, I think, baseball cap, says, you know, the injustice for me is every time I get stopped by the police, as though that's the beginning of the sentence, comma, and then they throw me on the ground and frisk me, they get really mad when they discover I'm female, biologically. And then they beat me. Right? And so a dilemma on this is we're sending out this survey with all these questions, many of which are created by young people, but we also have to gather other kinds of contextual data. So we've got spaces all over the country, Mississippi, the South, the North, California, Chicago, where we'll be gathering local data and creating kind of archives of lives. The amazing thing for me at that meeting was that young people are using this moment in history to challenge all the categories in ways that are quite beautiful and so far beyond where social sciences, so far beyond us, and we're still trying to track, are you discriminated against more based on these categories? The disability stuff was so beautifully complex, right? I think that's an invitation for us, those of us who are health researchers, critical psychologists, to think about how we engage this moment, both re-inscribing categories we know matter, but opening them up with the kind of lens that precarity has opened to young people, where we can kind of challenge those very categories. Let me just say one more thing about it, then I'm shutting up. After we gather all the data, we're bringing 10 activist groups from around the country together in New Orleans to analyze the data, and then they will go home and create online oral histories of elders and young people. So we'll have kind of an online gallery, and then they're going to come to New York and perform their research the night before the Pride March. This is the part that's totally cool, but that's because nothing has gotten screwed up yet. It's, we were talking about the conference a year ago. for a group of activists and crowd community members in New York. Thank you.
4 minutes off.
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Do you want to do a quick start? Do you want to?
Yeah. Well, let's just popcorn up a bunch and then I'll say something. But go, don't wait. Skip the first person, just go to the second. Go. I mean, nobody wants to be the first.
Wait. Come on. That little thing off, but you know, it will start someone else off. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, go
to
the second person.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think your definition of parity initially meant by making me think it's quite the marvelous issue. You talk about class a lot, you talk about diversity, but actually, so you're talking about dominant wealth group, but actually as your talk went on, it fractured into a whole variety of other identities.
I think the way precarity is being used in the world is very much about the economy and precarious employment and precarious income. And yet I think we can metabolize it to be a more intersectional and yeasty construct. That helps us think about the many fault lines and transformations in which young people are living.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Your idea of precarity of the elites, I think it's very useful. It made me think of something that just happened in my country. So we have legal abortion since 2007, after two referendums. The second one we won. And the last week, this famously right-wing woman, who's not she's not in the parliament or anything, but she's very much connected to conservative circles in my country. She's now, she managed to convince the government to try to implement this request to every woman who goes to a public clinic and goes undergoes the tests to for a safe abortion,
yeah,
to sign the echography of the baby or the fetus. So it's very interesting, this just now at the level of reproductive laws,
yeah,
and freedom,
yeah, yeah.
How the right wing elites in my country, for example, they deal with their own precarity,
yeah,
and trying to re-inscribe this very subtle and very dreadful mechanisms
and very aggressive.
Sure.
Very aggressive. I mean, last night we saw it in the film, right? And I think one of the things that's so striking to me about the aggressive greed and insertion of elites is often, at least in our country and in the film, that it's anonymous.
Sure.
Hiding behind money. So in a very, very minor way, the attack on me for challenging corporate ed reform, it's all anonymous. And African-Americans in our community say, in the South, they hide behind sheets, and in the North, they hide behind money and anonymity. But that's very interesting to me that elites don't actually come out. I mean, Donald Trump does, I guess, but just go away. But the anonymity, meanness, and the insatiable desire to control and contain.
Yeah, I thank you for your presentation. I thought it was wonderful and really got me thinking about a lot of different things. And one is, you know, you talked about the possibilities that are associated with kind of the challenge to all of these categories that we have, that all new kinds of new categories are being created as people are thinking in complex ways about their intersectional identities and locations and their embodied experiences and trying to come up with new categories. I'm wondering if you've given some thought to the dangers of people being able to move from one category to another, and maybe from a category of privilege to claim an other category.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm thinking about the sort of well-known on social media discussion about Rachel Dolezal, and if you have any thoughts about how that slipperiness can also work against social justice.
I think I want to say three contradictory things at once, can I?
Okay. Yes.
But I think that should be a topic for the next conference,
yeah,
right? How do we engage?
Yeah.
We are, many of us, holding on to categories,
yeah,
that do and don't,
yeah,
live in the bodies of the folks for whom, with whom, beside whom we are speaking. And yet,
yeah,
if you have a social justice orientation,
yeah,
you want to still be able to demonstrate disparate treatment. It's a little like the boycott thing. There's got to be something between reinscribing, you're black no matter what, and or you're gay when you're choosing not to do that, or you have a disability. Disability area is really tricky. These young people are not so eager to acknowledge, and yet, one of the things that disability rights groups have said to us is gay kids with disabilities are really suffering. They're not getting sex ed, they're not getting any recognition of who they are. Everybody assumes they're gay because they're disabled and can't really be sure. Anyway, so I think the case, this is a case of a white woman who claimed she was black and then headed up the end. I mean, I think that's weird and somebody should talk to her. And some of her parents did you catch the parents? The parents adopted all these black kids and weren't very good to, so something funky was, but I worry less about that, and but I do worry about us inscribing categories, particularly because we do all this participatory work, inscribing categories that people are resisting, and if we just go with what they're saying. So like on our thing, we say, if this were the census, what would your race ethnicity be? Choose all that apply. If this were, you know, what would your sexuality be? The gender conformity thing is really hard to figure out how you ask about, and yet it is crucial in terms of stuff happening with cops and suspensions. Mm-hmm. But we've just done like a dry run, and African-American women in the U.S. are much more likely than white women to rate themselves as more masculine and gender conforming. Mm-hmm. Like white women who give the same rating on masculinity say that, well, of course, all of these categories are already inscribed. But I think at the moment we have to be bilingual. Yeah. Maybe we have to, and so we have like a section that says, ouch, the next section is going to ask you for categories. We know some people aren't comfortable with this, but so we want to know what sex were you assigned to birth. And when we asked the 150, half of them were so happy we asked it, and the other said, it is structural violence for you to even ask that question. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, right. So I think we're at a liminal moment, mm-hmm. and maybe work with our community partners to figure out language. These young people have been so generous in helping us think of language that can answer the justice questions and respect the fluidity. We're done. Are we done?
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.